Welcome to The World Shapers, conversations with science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm your host, Edward Willett, and this episode's guest, Violet Malan. Welcome to another episode of The World Shapers, the podcast where I talk to other science fiction and fantasy authors about the creative process. I'm Edward Willett. I'm your host. I am myself an author of science fiction and fantasy. My main publisher is Daw Books, but I also publish through Shadowpaw Press and other publishers. And my latest book is actually through Shadowpaw Press. It's a young adult science fiction novel called Star Song, and it's kind of dear to my heart because it's one of the first books that I tried to get published many, many years ago, and it came very close to being published by a major publisher in the 90s, and then something changed at the publisher, and they decided not to take it, and it hadn't found a home. So I recently rewrote it, have brought it out through Shadowpaw Press. Well, here, I'll just read the back cover. When the old woman who raised him in a remote village is murdered, Chris Lamarck finds himself alone on a planet where he'll always be an outsider. His only link to his long-dead, unknown parents is the touch lyre they bequeathed him, a strange instrument that not only plays music but pours his innermost feelings into the minds of his listeners. When Tavera, a girl of the space-going nomadic family, hears Chris perform, she is drawn to him against her better judgment and the rules of her people. With her help, though, mistrusted and even hated by some of her comrades, Chris seeks to discover the origin of the touch lyre, the fate of his parents, and a place where he truly belongs. But the touch lyre proves to be more than just a musical oddity. Powerful, ruthless men will stop at nothing to get it, and Chris and Tavera are all that stand in their way. I like to say that this one is very much in the mode of Robert A. Heinlein and Andre Norton, whose young adult stories were the ones that I grew up on and that certainly interested me in science fiction to a large extent in the first place. So I'm very happy to have that out. It's called Star Song. It's from Shadowpaw Press, and it's available everywhere online in both print and ebook formats. You can also get it directly through Shadowpaw Press, shadowpawpress.com. The other thing coming from Shadowpaw Press will be Shapers of Worlds Volume 2. This is the anthology of short fiction by authors who have been guests on this podcast. Last year, I kickstarted the original Shapers of Worlds, which is now available everywhere, again, in ebook and paperback as well, even hardcover on Amazon, Shapers of Worlds. And it featured first-year guests, and then that worked. So this year, I kickstarted a new anthology, Volume 2, which features second-year guests. So when it comes out this fall, Shapers of Worlds Volume 2 will feature new fiction from Kelly Armstrong, Marie Brennan, Helen Dale, Candace Jane Dorsey, Lisa Foyles, Susan Forrest, James Allen Gardner, Matthew Hughes, Helly Kennedy, Lisa Kester, Adria Laycraft, Ira Naiman, Garth Nix, Tim Pratt, Edward Savio, Brian Thomas Schmidt, Jeremy Saul, and me, plus stories by Jeffrey A. Carver, Barb Hambly, Nancy Kress, David D. Levine, S.M. Sterling, and Carrie Vaughn. And as you can probably tell, among those authors are winners and nominees for every major science fiction and fantasy literary award and several international bestsellers. So I'm very excited about that. I'm working on editing it right now. It'll be out, I won't promise September, but certainly by October. It should be available, or November at the very, very latest. So that's something to look forward to as well. And the other thing I'm working on is my next book for Daw Books. It's called The Tangled Stars. It's humorous space opera, just on the verge of submitting that now, and it'll be out next year sometime. Anyway, that's enough about me and the latest from Shadowpaw Press. I do hope you'll check all that out at shadowpawpress.com or at my website, edwardwillett.com. But now it's time to get on to this episode's guest, another Daw author, Violet Malan. Violet Malan is the author of the Dylan and Parno Sword and Sorcery series and the Mirrorland series of primary world fantasies. As V.M. Escalada, she's the author of The Ferriman Prophecy, including Halls of Law and Gift of Griffins. She's on Facebook, she's on Twitter at Violet Malan, and website-wise, you can check either violetmalan.com or vmescalada.com, but she says, not that it's up to date, because it isn't. She strongly urges you to remember that no one expects the Spanish Inquisition. So, Violet, welcome to the World Shapers.
Oh, it's great to be here.
You're in Spain. I'm in Canada. 8 hours difference, but we managed to make it work, so.
Well, You know, I think that's been happening a lot more in the last 18 months to 2 years, as people are using, you know, the available technology to connect with people in other countries and indeed people down the street, you know, when you're not allowed to leave the house. Well, and so all kinds of great stuff is happening.
Well, I'm finding a time that works with you is a lot easier than the couple or three times I've talked to people in Australia. That one's always, okay, it's tomorrow. And
that's true.
Now, I always look for connections. And, of course, we have a big one in that we're both published by Daw Books, and we share an editor, the marvelous Sheila E. Gilbert. Yeah. So I was just saying before we started that, you know, I could talk to all the Daw authors, but I feel I have to spread it out a little bit. So,
but, well, yeah, you don't want to seem like you're, you know, too narrow in your approach.
Exactly. And you have a new book coming up very shortly, so this was a good to talk to you. And we'll talk about that a little later on. But first, I'll do what I do with all of the guests, which is to take you back into the mists of time. Ooh. And find out, you know, well, where you grew up. You have a kind of interesting background. And how you got interested in, I presume, you started as a reader, we all seem to, writing, and science fiction fantasy specifically, although you write other stuff as well. So, tell me about yourself, Violet.
Well, people who already know me, of course, already know all this stuff. My mother was Spanish, my father was Polish. They met after the Second World War, immigrated to Canada, where I was born a month later in Toronto. So, on the one hand, I'm Canadian by birth, certainly, and it is the country in which I grew up. But on the other hand, I'm also European because, as any child of immigrants will tell you, inside your house, it tends to be the culture that your parents came from, not the culture that's outside of your house. So in that respect, we were, both my brother and I were always a little bit unusual because we knew things that our friends didn't know. We spoke languages our friends didn't speak and, you know, this kind of thing. But I think that, as you're saying, most of us do start off reading whatever genre it is we finally end up writing. And in my case, it's entirely my brother's fault. So when I was about 8 years old, my brother said to me, I found this great book. You must read it. It's wonderful. You'll love it. And it was The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. So the next time my school class went to the public library, I immediately asked the librarian for this book. And basically, my brother was 100% correct. It's a wonderful book. I loved it. I still love it. And that, I think, introduced me to the fantasy side of things. And it was also Oscar, my brother, who recommended to me my first science fiction novel, which was How Spacesuit Will Travel by Robert Heinlein. So again, entirely Oscar's fault. And he's still doing it, by the way. He still recommends books to me.
It's funny, his name's Oscar with Half Spacesuit Will Travel.
Exactly. I think it was one of the few occasions where he was actually happy to come across his name in print. The other one was, of course, there's Oscar Levant, and there's a couple of other, you know, famous Oscars. But most of the time, he didn't like the name. And you know, people will say to me, like, your brother's name is Oscar? And I'll say, well, you know, then if I'm called Violet, you know, my brother's not going to be Dave, you know. So, and vice versa, of course. But he now owns the only independent bookstore left in Kingston, Ontario. And he is constantly recommending books to people, other people, obviously, as well as myself. So he's still doing it.
So that got you interested in both fantasy and science fiction at a fairly young age. When did you start thinking you might want to write it? And were there other books in there that were very influential as well?
Strangely enough, most of the books that I read at that time seem, in hindsight, to have been British. So I didn't read, you know, well, actually, no, I did read a couple of Nancy Drew mysteries, but I didn't go farther, I think, than the second or third one, because it struck me that they were all the same story.
It's kind of the point.
So, I was really disappointed, so I didn't read any more. But I read, Oh, I read in the fantasy line, of course, I read Nesbitt, I read Dunsany, I read, when I got older, I read the a lot of the Pre-Raphaelites because I had to do a course in the late 19th century poetry. So I read a lot of that. Tennyson, always my favorite. You know, it's stupid. I know that I was reading other things, but at the moment, my mind is a blank.
Well, you know, I'm sort of the same way. I read a million books, but trying to suddenly pick them up, I ran into the same problem.
Yeah, yeah.
But you started writing almost right away then, didn't you?
Well, I didn't write things down, but what I did was I told stories. And I think, as is also, I think, fairly common with a lot of writers, you start off by telling other people's stories because you realize that your friends at school have not seen the Errol Flynn movie with, about Robin Hood because their fathers are not, you know, massive Errol Flynn fans. So they don't know the story of Robin Hood, so you tell it to them. So it's a kind of storytelling thing because you learn the beats, you learn the things that are that because you're actually watching people's faces. You learn the parts that they find interesting, you can tell. So if you go to tell the story again, you're telling it in a kind of edited way because you know that this particular piece of the story went over big last time. You know, and that piece didn't. So I think that's what I started off doing was telling other people's stories. And because, you know, there's a limit to how much you can read when you're 10 or 11 years old, though, again, it doesn't seem that way looking back on it. Eventually, you have to start making up your own stories because you're running out of things that your friends haven't heard of.
So when did you start writing things down?
I wrote a play. I wrote the class play in grade 6. And I wrote a bunch of short stories for different competitions and stuff all through public school. In high school, I didn't as much. I think I was just, I think I was working a lot. So I didn't write as much. I kept reading, but I didn't write as much. I started writing again when I was in university. More specifically, when I was in graduate school, because, you know, there's only so much 18th century poetry you can read and you have to take a break from it. And why not, you know, toss off a good sword and sorcery story as being the exact opposite of 18th century pastoral poetry?
Because you actually have a PhD in 18th century literature, don't you?
I do. Yeah.
Has that depth of looking at a particular time period and looking at the way that language was used then, has that influenced your writing going forward, do you think? I always ask that about whatever people studied in university.
Yeah, I think so. For me, the 18th century has always been the most interesting one because it's a century of change. And, you know, genres changed, the way people approached writing changed. The first novels were written. This all happened in the 18th century in English literature anyway. So it gave me an idea of great freedom in a way because I'm convinced because of my studies in that area that genre is a fiction. It's how, you know, people like to categorize things like saying, oh, it's 18th century literature, you immediately categorize it. But when people first started writing, they just wrote novels. You can't say that Don Quixote is or is like, is it magic realism? It is if you're looking at it from the point of view of Don Quixote. But then they didn't worry so much about, is this fantasy? Is this fiction? Is this, you know, whatever? So I tend to feel that way myself. Like I'm always a little astonished when people say, like they categorize things a little too much for me, I think. And most people, and I do it myself probably a little bit, but I always think about Sir Philip Sidney And he wrote an essay on the defense of poetry. And in his day, there were two genres. There was poetry and there was prose. That was it.
And I was going to say, the only creative writing class I took in university, our book was called Three Genres, and it was poetry, prose, and plays. Those were they'd expanded it out one more. So, I remember reading, I thought genre fiction was what I liked to read and write, but here it was much.
Well, of course, what Sidney meant by poetry was anything fictional. So for him, drama entered into that end of things. Prose was nonfiction. So, you know, it didn't have to rhyme for it to be poetry. It just had to be it had to be fiction.
That seems like probably a reasonable division of things, actually. Basically, nonfiction and fiction.
But, you know, when you think about it, you realize that at that time, they didn't have anywhere near the number of readers. You know, the percentage of the population who could actually read was considerably less than 5%. So, you know, whatever books there were, those were the books you read, because there weren't that many more. In fact, that's another reason that I like the 18th century, is that it's the last century in which people could have read every book available to them. And, of course, any book translated into English, any book that was in Latin or Greek, if they could read Latin or Greek, every single book available, you could read it in your lifetime.
Mm.
And that hasn't been true since then.
I guess there was a period of time when you could have read every single science fiction book.
I think so.
I think even when I was a kid, you almost could have. But not now.
I think you're right.
Well, and
I think you're right.
And going back to science fiction and fantasy, when did you start writing and trying to get published? How did that all come about? I mean, you've done other things. So, and what were some of the other things you've done?
Oh, you mean like working?
Yeah.
Well, I've been a shop assistant. I have been, let's see, what have I done? I've been a coffee girl and a bingo. I've been a waitress. I have been a bookkeeper. I've, for years without, when Paul, my husband, was working, I kept all his books. I managed all the tax stuff and all that kind of thing. And I also pitched in as a carpenter's assistant when he needed an extra pair of hands that really didn't, you know, need much skill, like, you know, hold this and or fetch me that. So, I've done, in that sense, I've done a bunch of different things, but mostly I've either been, I've been an administrative assistant. When I stopped trying to get an academic position, because in the time that I graduated, there just weren't any available. And so I was writing, I began writing fiction more. And the more I wrote fiction, the less I wanted to have a regular full-time job. So what I did was I became an office temp. So I've done absolutely everything in Kingston Regional Cancer Center and the Kingston General Hospital, other than actually being a clinician. So if there's any kind of support position, I've done it. So what I found was, you know, I could work for 3 weeks and that would allow me to write for 3 months. So that's pretty well what I did up until when I had some short stories published. They were mostly mystery stories. And then my first novel, of course, I think it was 2006. I think I'm right. And that was The Mirror Prince, the first novel that I had with Daw. And, you know, after that, I still worked, but I think maybe 2 years after that, I stopped working full time or taking jobs, and I wrote full time.
Did you?
And that's what I've been doing since.
Did you place that first one just on spec, or did you get an agent first and then they got it?
I got an agent first because, I mean, again, talking about DAW authors, we both know Tanya Huff really well. And Tanya,
and she's been on the show.
And there you go. And she lives near, she, well, I was going to say she lives near me, but I should call, I should change that and say she once lived, I once lived near her. And she learned that I was going to a mystery conference in convention in Toronto. And her agent, Joshua Bilmes, was also going to be there. So she arranged for us to meet. And so my work was submitted to DAW via, not until like 2 years later, but Joshua became my agent, and he's handled all my stuff since then.
Well, you've had several novels since then, and you have a new one coming out, I think, August 3rd. Is that the release date?
I think so. It's usually the first Tuesday or something, so and I'm never really sure.
This we'll get this live just about the same time that comes out. So,
oh, that's great.
So we'll start talking about your creative process and all of your books, but you know we'll talk about the new one especially. So maybe the place to start then, because this starts a new series for you, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I so far there's only two books, so I kind of hesitate to call it a series. So there's the first book is The Godstone, and the second book, which is the one I'm writing right now, and it does not have a title. Is basically a follow-up to The Godstone. Whether there are going to be any further stories set in this universe depends on a number of factors, some of which are not under my control. So, you know, obviously I would need to come up with an idea. That's under my control. But, you know, other more practical, more pragmatic factors are not under my control.
Oh, yes.
So, I mean, as you know,
yes,
as you know.
But, okay, well, we'll call it a duology for now then. but maybe the best place to start is with a synopsis of the first one without giving away anything you don't want to give away.
Oh, I'm really, really terrible at synopses. I mean, it's
Give me an elevator pitch then, something just brief.
Oh, I'm even worse at those. somebody, one of the reviews, I think it was either the review in Kirkus or the review in Publishers Weekly. When I read the review, I thought that is the most brilliant synopsis of the book I have ever heard.
Yeah, I've experienced that too, where the reviewer really nailed it down.
Yeah. So, yes, indeed, you know, I actually used it because the cover, you know, the cover copy that I had sent to DAW, you know, a year ago or more, when they sent me the galleys, the proofs, and I read the cover copy and I thought you guys were going to fix this. It was terrible. And then I thought, well, you know, if I did a combination of this stuff that I wrote, you know, 18 months ago and this wonderful synopsis in this review, if I could kind of mush those two things together, you know, I would have a great, great cover stuff. So that's, in fact, what I did. So, but you're serious. You actually want me to.
Well, I think we should tell people something about the book before we start talking about it. So
this is. There are two main characters. One is Fenra, a female character, and the other is Arlen. And Fenra is a practitioner. And a practitioner is what we in our universe would call a magician or a sorcerer. And so they, it's a, oh God, she practices mostly as a healer. And Arlen is one of her patients, and he has a chronic condition that they call lowness. And we would call it, in our universe, we would call it depression. And she manages to keep him leveled. And then one day he's kind of in a tizzy because he needs to go to the city. And he needs to go to the city because he has been asked to execute a distant relative's will. And he knows for a fact that this distant relative never wrote a will. So he needs to get to the city to find out what's going on, because the distant relative was a practitioner and likely has some dangerous stuff in and among his possessions. And Arlen is trying to make sure that none of those dangerous objects makes their way into the hands of modern day or, you know, yeah, current practitioners. So Fenra goes along with him to help and to make sure that he doesn't get low on his way to the city.
Okay, sounds like a fun setup. Fun is the right word. Exciting. So this is where I ask the question that authors profess to hate to be asked, and yet it's a legitimate question. I won't phrase it as, where do you get your ideas? Let's say, where does the seed come from that blossoms in the fertile ground of your imagination?
Who is it that called it a germ?
That sounds about right.
I think it was one of the French novelists. I wouldn't be surprised if it was them.
I think my favorite who was it? David B. Coe maybe said that there's ideas sleeting and you just have to be dense enough to stop one of them when it impacts. But they're sleeting around you all the time.
Oh, yeah. It's like the neutrinos.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I think my ideas come from the same places that everybody else does. The world around you. Something you've read, something you've watched on television. How many times have you seen something badly done and you think to yourself, I could have done that. I could have written that so much better. I would have done it this way. And I would have got rid of that character entirely. And the next thing you know, you have a book. So, you know, ideas just, it's like you say, they fall on you.
Where did this particular one fall from?
This one, strangely enough, started off as a mystery story. In that there was a guy who had, and I'm not really giving anything away at this point because this is in the synopsis, that's in the cover copy. There's a guy, you know, living out in the country, minding his own business, who gets a letter from the lawyer saying, we need you to come into Toronto and execute your cousin's will. And he knows perfectly well that his cousin didn't leave a will because he is his cousin.
Oh.
He arranged for his death. You know, everybody thinks he's dead. It's now been 7 years and they want to process things. So he knows perfectly well that he is not the executor of the will that he left, if you follow me. So I thought, I had some ideas of where that could go. And you know how it is, you have a drawer full of notes and half-started chapters and that kind of thing. And when I was thinking about moving to Spain, I was starting to go through all of my drawers full of paper to see what was going to go and what wasn't going to go. And I came across the outline of this idea, and I thought, this would make a great fantasy novel. So that's what I did.
My favorite is the cryptic handwritten note that you can't quite read anymore. Mm-hmm, I run into those.
Yeah, I keep saying, remember, and then I can't read the rest of it. So clearly something of vital importance that I wrote down but now can't read. Yeah.
So once you have this germ, how do you culture it? And, you know, what happens in the Petri dish so that it grows into something more substantial than just that initial, oh, this is a good idea?
For me, I think it's always the characters. I always start off with dialogue. I imagine two people talking about something or, you know, meeting for the first time or having a fight, you know, having an argument, something like that. And so then, in that sense, for me, the characters and the plot kind of move forward at the same time. Because, you know, on the one hand, you can't have action or plot without characters. But on the other hand, you really can't have characters without giving them something to do. So, but I think that's how it sort of expands from there. For me, I usually start off with two characters, not necessarily male and female, though it usually is that way for me. And I think that's because I have spent a good deal more than half of my life in a male-female relationship. And so to me, it seems easier to deal with than something else. And then, of course, they have to interact with other people, and more conversations are happening, and more characters get introduced, and then it kind of grows from there.
So do you do a detailed outline, or are you more organic in the way that the story grows?
I actually do both, because usually Joshua, my agent, and Sheila, my editor, want an outline. So, you know, if I'm pitching the next book, for example, I usually have two or three different ideas on the go, and I send them outlines for all of my ideas. And Sheila will say, well, this one sounds good. Let's work on this one. So, but I find out how little detail there is when I'm stuck, you know, three quarters of the way through the book. And I think, oh, I must have said something about this in that outline. And I look, and the outline, you know, it's like the last half of it basically says, oh, and then they did something great, and they triumphed.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, yeah, did you not have any ideas of how they were going to manage that? Because that's what I need to know right now.
Yeah, that's exactly my experience. Yeah. That's exactly my experience with that kind of thing. You get there.
So my outlines are not as, you know, nothing like the outlines that I wrote for, you know, my dissertation or something like that, which were, in fact, very detailed. Sometimes you don't know what's going to happen until you get there.
It's literally what I'm going through with my next book for DAW, which is coming out next year. I wrote this, and you know, it sounded great, and then I started writing it, and then I got to a point where I was stuck, and I said, well, it's time to look back at the old synopsis. And the synopsis said something like, you know, hijinks ensued. It wasn't quite like that, but basically.
Yeah.
There are narrow escapes or something. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
so, you know, the good guys dealt with the bad guys.
Yeah.
And there you go.
And then, as I've often mentioned on here, you know, one of the things about doing this podcast is how everybody is different. And there are the people that just start writing and see what happens. And there's the people that are sort of like us, where you have a synopsis, but it's not entirely complete as to what's going to need to be in the story. And then I always go back to Peter V. Brett, who told me he writes 150-page outlines before he even starts writing a story. And I think that's the most extreme at the other end. So there's a wide variety of ways to approach the problem.
Exactly. And I think that what I find most interesting is people's reaction to the idea of an outline. Because people who use them on a regular basis and write fairly detailed ones, maybe not quite as detailed as Peter's, but detailed, they will always say the same thing. It doesn't stifle your creativity, because it isn't a contract. It's not carved in stone. You can change your mind. You don't have to do what the outline, you know, what you thought of 6 months ago, or sometimes 6 years ago, when you wrote down the outline. And I think that a lot of people fear the outlining process, because they see it as shackling themselves. And it just isn't.
Or they think that the creative process that goes into creating the outline or the synopsis takes all the creative juice out of it. And after that, it just becomes drudgery, because they've already had all the creative sparkles have been sprinkled onto the outline.
As you can tell, not a problem that I have, because very little of the creative process found its way into the 3 or 4 page outline. So that's not a worry that I have.
And then there's you just have to do a synopsis because, as you said, Sheila wants to see one before she decides if she's going to contract you for a book or not. So
Well, sometimes, of course, you know, I sell the book, you know, though it will sound incredible at the moment since I can't seem to sell this one. I will tell Sheila what the idea is, and she'll say, great, write up a synopsis for that one and send it in. And I've always imagined it as, you know, in the old-fashioned sense, they need something for the file. You know, the financial office needs to know what they've bought. So there has to be a piece of paper, you know, preferably 3 to 5 pieces of paper that can go into this file that will justify the fact that they've sent you money. But I don't think anybody looks at the outline after you've sent it in. Nobody.
And I do tell that to people who, you know, ask me about the process is that, well, don't you have to put in exactly what you put in the synopsis? And I said, no. You have to produce a book, but it doesn't have to. Nobody's going back and saying, oh, you know, well, on page 3 of the synopsis, you said this was going to happen. But on page 247 of the book, something entirely different happened. That's not how it works. Thank goodness.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. Like, I'm sure even Peter Brett doesn't follow, you know, line by line, word by word. I'm sure he comes across something and thinks of something, you know, gets to a point, thinks of something that's way better than what he came up with in the first place. And he's going to run with that. He's not going to go, oh, I'm not going to use my really terrific idea because that's not what I put in the outline. No, no, no.
Yeah, the important thing is the finished product.
Exactly.
And speaking of the process of getting to the finished project, What does your actual putting words down look like? Do you work a certain number of hours? Do you like to work at home? Do you like to go out somewhere else? How does that work for you? Do you write longhand under a tree?
I write by hand if I find myself if I'm out and about, and it particularly happens that like if we're in a restaurant or, you know, Paul will get up to either like pay the bill, go to the bathroom, whatever, and at that moment something falls into my brain and I have to, you know, pull the little notebook that I always carry with me out of my purse, and it is a very little notebook because it has to fit in any sized purse, and I madly scribble things. And I've been handed, paper placemats by waiters and waitresses because they see I'm running out of paper. So sometimes that happens. But that's more, I think, of I'd better write this down before I forget it writing rather than actual composition. Usually I do 80% of my work in the house, because I used to live in the country, 45 minutes away from the nearest coffee shop. So I didn't have a lot of options of where I was going to work. So I might work upstairs or downstairs or on the deck or on the front porch or, you know, something like that. But it was always at home. And of course, that experience came in very handy during the whole lockdown for COVID, because here in Spain, you weren't allowed to go out for any reason except to grocery shop and to walk your dog and to go to the bank. Those were the only reasons that you were allowed to leave the house. And they're far more careful with enforcing this kind of thing, you know, because you are, they're very concerned about the public safety and the health of people. And they take it very seriously. I think they just like to stop you and say, what are you doing? But, you know, that's me. But I found the fact that I didn't move around a lot in while I was writing, I was always at home. I found that good practice for being always at home.
Yeah, so, I like to write out, and I actually found that my writing, oddly enough, I felt like I wasn't as effective writing at home, even though I technically work from home for 20 some years now. I missed not being here when I was doing the actual first draft, kind of really writing side of things. So it was interesting to me because I didn't expect it to have any particular impact on the way I worked, and yet it actually kind of did psychologically, I mean, as much as anything.
Yeah, interesting. I know that I always got a lot done on days that I would be going into Kingston to have lunch with someone or something like that. I always went in first thing in the morning and sat in a coffee shop and wrote until, you know, the time for my appointment arrived. And I would find that I would get a tremendous, like I would get my whole day's work done in an hour and a half or 2 hours sitting in the coffee shop because there were no distractions. You know, I can't decide to go and see what the cat's doing.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's like you're there first. Well, you're there to have coffee and write. You have to have coffee or they look at you funny. But
well, yeah, yeah. Or tea in my case, since I can't drink coffee. But yeah, no, same thing. You got to have something. You got to have something. Or they do. They look at you funny. I did at one point have to change coffee shops because the woman who worked there was so fascinated by what I was doing that she wouldn't let me do it. So she just talked to me the whole time. And like she'd go and she'd serve somebody and then she'd come back and continue talking to me. And I never felt comfortable. Like people would say to me, well, just tell her you're working. And I never felt comfortable doing that. So like in a, I suppose, kind of very passive aggressive way, I just changed coffee shops.
Are you a fast writer or a slow writer?
Yes.
Depends, huh?
Yeah. I have sat down. I think my record for one day is like, it's close to 4,000 words. It's like 3,700 and something. And you can imagine that day went by like a snap of the fingers. Because, you know, when you're in the groove,
yeah,
you go. Everything else disappears. And this is, I've always been very lucky in that, unlike some of my friends in the business, my parents, which in practical terms was my mother at the point that I started writing seriously, were very supportive of the idea of my being a writer and of the necessity of my having support in a variety of ways. You know, like one time I needed to replace my computer and my mother bought me a new one. Because after all, she said, it's like buying you a new pen. You know, if you write with the computer, then you have to have it. And I've said this before in other contexts that I find that people in Spain are far more supportive in general terms of the arts. If I say to somebody here, they don't say, do you make very much money at that? Or have they made a movie out of it? You know, what they say is, well, you know, basically what they say is, that's fantastic. What do you write? And they're the idea that somebody is a writer and maybe doesn't actually make much of a living at it. It's commonplace here. Like people don't say, you know, I'm an office manager. They say I'm a painter. And people accept that that's what you really do. You might be doing other things to earn money, but that's not your work. That's just your job. And that seems to be, in Spain anyway, it seems to be very widespread in people's reactions to, and I do have members of my family who were painters or who were poets, and they felt the same. They felt that the culture supports the creation of things in a way that I don't think North American culture does.
Once you've got a draft, what does your revision process look like? Do you use beta readers or anything like that, like some people do?
No.
Or what's that all? How does that work for you?
I'm afraid I don't write fast enough for a beta reader because what happens is, you know, I hand the manuscript in to DAW, and I suppose that in that sometimes lengthy period before I hear back from them, I could hand the manuscript to somebody else, but most of the people that I would consider feasible, usable as beta readers are obviously many of them writers themselves, and they're doing the same thing I'm doing. They're trying to get their manuscript finished. So I think the only person that reads it before I send it is Paul, my husband. And of course, he he always loves it. So it's not a useful reader in terms of critique.
It's like showing it to your mother.
Yeah. Except my mother would have said, I don't like this part.
You know, my mom would have said, I don't really like science fiction and fantasy. That's what she would have said.
Oh, my Paul was one time trying to convince his mother to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer because, you know, it's fun. And when he was explaining to her what it was about, she goes, oh, I don't watch that stuff.
Yeah.
So, we're in the car on the way home and Paul says, I noticed that you refrained from pointing out to her that you write that stuff. And I said, yeah, she doesn't know because she's never read any of my books. Yeah. So, you know, as long as they buy them, you know, I'm happy with that. But that was the thing that I would get. Whereas, and here again, you know, if I can just circle around to what I was saying about Spain, is they don't care what genre it is. They understand
nice.
The concept, you know, they know that there is such a thing, but they think it's something the French do, you know, because it's a French word, isn't it? Yeah. So it must be something the French do. We don't do that here. And they're contemporary writers. There aren't mystery writers or science fiction writers or fantasy writers. There's just writers. So you get people like Ruiz Zafón or Arturo Pérez Reverte, and their books are far more inclusive. There's all kinds of things going on. Sometimes there are fantasy elements involved. Sometimes there are, yeah, I suppose there could be science fiction elements, but not as much as there is fantasy.
What does your personal revision then look like? You're not showing it to anybody else, but you must have, going back through it, what sorts of things do you find yourself having to work on after the initial getting it down?
Well,
do you do a rolling revision as you go along?
I do a little bit as I go. But, of course, the closer I get to the end of the manuscript, the less rolling revision I do because, of course, I now see the end. At least I hope I do. And I'm anxious to get there because then I can go back to the beginning and I keep notes as I go. And I keep notes like, if I haven't made this clear earlier, or I'll say something like, I don't know whether I've talked about this or not. If I haven't, well then this is the first place it appears. And if I have, I need to find that spot and attend to it. So I often write myself notes like, look for this, check if you've said this already. Because the process of writing the whole book is a lengthy process, and you're not always going to remember whether these two particular characters have had this discussion already. At least I don't.
And it's worse in a series when it's maybe three books ago when you, you have to check back and see. I've been on a couple of panels, and I haven't written. My longest series was a YA series that was five books, but I've been on panels talking about the challenges of writing series, and continuity always comes up as one that's a pain, and even within a single book, that can be a pain.
Well, somebody told me, I think it was Charlene Harris, said that thankfully her very best friend and first major fan made a like an encyclopedia of the Sookie Stackhouse novels, so that if Charlene couldn't remember the color of this particular character's eyes, which is what always throws me off,
yes,
she could refer to this, you know, carefully cross-referenced encyclopedic reference that her friend had created for her.
We should all have such friends.
That's what I said. I said, is she busy next week? You know, I mean, for sure. But yeah, I do that as I'm writing. I mean, a lot of people are using that. Oh God, now I can't remember what's Scrivener.
Oh yeah. I've got it, but I haven't climbed the learning curve to use it.
That's what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid of the learning curve. So I've always kept separately, like, descriptions of every time I mention a character, I write the name down. I decide what the character looks like, even if it's what seems to be a walk-on at the moment, or, you know, like a bit player, because I don't know that I might not want to use that person for something else later. So I might as well know, you know, what she looks like, how tall she is, you know, what her voice sounds like, you know, that kind of thing. But I don't go into, you know, what her favorite ice cream is, or, you know, that's for the main characters. Not that there's a lot of ice cream in my books. Interesting.
I don't think I've had any ice cream. Oh, maybe in the one, the young adult book, there might have been some ice cream.
Yeah.
So now we come to the fun part, where it has gone in to your agent and to Sheila.
Right.
What kind of feedback do you get at that point? I mean, I know how Sheila works, but others don't. So what's the editorial process like?
Well, I think the great thing about Sheila is that she wants your book to be the best book you can write. She doesn't want it to be the best book she can write. So she'll have areas. Usually what she says to me is, I need more infrastructure. You know, I need more of the political background, the social background, because I tend to write, like, the characters are not going to discuss the nature of their political setup in their city because they know what it is. So sometimes I just take it for granted, and I don't actually say enough for the reader to know what it is. So that's usually with Sheila, that's the thing that she asks me to do first, is put in more infrastructure.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. And, you know, often it's kind of different for each book. I mean, I remember for the first book, because of course Joshua took me over it. I think I did 7 drafts of The Mirror Prince before I handed it in. And, you know, Sheila said, could you give us a little bit more detail, you know, on page 29? Oh, and on page 42, that would work out well too. And that was it. I didn't have any other, you know, since then I've had a lot more input. And I think what, in talking over things with Sheila and with Joshua too, it's the they ask you a question and you see whether you can answer it or not. You know, like, why did the character do this, or why is this happening? And if you have an answer, well, then maybe you didn't make it clear enough. They didn't see it. Or maybe you don't have an answer, and then you realize that you've got a little bit more thinking to do about this part.
It sounds like, it sounds like your books probably get longer then after the editorial consultation. Mine certainly
does. Yes. I mean, one of the things that my agent, Joshua Bilmes, always says to me is that I am the only person, his only client, that he has to say, add stuff. He says he's got a client in Australia that always needs to cut 30,000 words, and I usually need to add 20 or 30,000 words. And if he could only just somehow meld us together, he would get the perfect book the first time.
I think I'd rather add than cut myself, but
yeah. Well, I think that's the academic training. You know, we were always told, If you're asked for a 25-page essay, write a 25-page essay. The professor has to read a lot of different essays, and she's not going to want to read one that's 60 pages when she wants to read a 25-page one. So make your point in the 25 pages, or the 50 pages, or the whatever it is. So essentially, you're taught to write very concisely. Get your information across clearly, but concisely. And at least when I first started writing fiction full time, I tended to do the same thing. And I think that is what led to Sheila saying stuff like, we need more political background, or we need more social infrastructure. Now I'm a little bit more aware of that, so I tend to put it in already. And then, you know, sometimes I have to explain it because I didn't put it in very well.
And then once the book is out in public, going back to your first one, were you pleased with reaction? What's your relationship with readers been?
I have to say that I've been pleased at the reaction to all of my books. I've gotten some odd things where, and I'm sure this has happened to you as well, people comment on the cover. Like there's something they saw about the artwork that they thought was wrong. And to which, you know, the answer is, I didn't draw the cover. And I think we get a fair amount of input into the cover art.
Yeah.
But most people don't. At least that's what I've been told. It's they've just, the first time they see the cover is when the first time they see the book.
Yeah, I've heard that too. And I've been consulted several times on covers with, you know, here's two ways we could go and that sort of thing. So
yeah, exactly. And of course, I'm also getting input from Joshua on that as well. And of course, you know, his angle is that since he sells things professionally, as it were, he knows what the cover should be. So he always wants input. And I'm always kind of torn between, you know, Sheila is not Joshua's client. Joshua is not Sheila's writer. So can I take something that Sheila has given me and show it to Joshua? Well, certainly not without asking. But, you know, I sometimes feel that I'm kind of in the middle because, you know, the publisher wants one thing and the agent wants something else. And it's you feel like saying, look, you guys want to just get on the phone? You know, like that's your job. Your job is to argue with each other, not to get me to persuade one of you to do something, you know, but that doesn't happen very often. And as I say, it's often to do with the cover art. But yeah, I've had people, I'm always surprised when I'm at a con, like a world con, where, you know, they give you your autographing times. And I'm always surprised that people come with books to be autographed. And I think, you know, surely by the fifth or sixth time that that's happened, I would stop being surprised. And yet, no, I'm still surprised.
I would. It's always a little humbling, though, if you're there and like George R. Martin's down at one end. Or
that actually happened to me.
It happened to me, too. Yeah.
Well, was this in where was it? He was down at one end and he had a signing time every day. Like, you know, 1 to 2:30 or something like that.
It could have been.
You know Derwin Mack.
Yes.
Derwin and I were scheduled for the same time period. So Derwin said, let's sit together. Because then when everybody is lining up for George R. R. Martin to sign their book and no one is standing in front of us, we can talk to each other and act like that's really why we're there. We're just having fun, you know. And at one point, of course, because everybody comes to get their book signed by George R. R. Martin in the first 45 minutes. And at one point, Derwin, who was facing in that direction, said, oh, Violet, look, there's nobody in front of him either.
Yes, autograph sessions can be quite humbling. But it's always nice when somebody does show up with a book and it's like, wow.
That's so cool. I know.
Well, let's get to the big philosophical questions to wrap up here. I gave them to you ahead of time. The first one is, why do you write? The second one is, why do you think any of us write? Why do people do this strange thing where we tell made-up stories? And then the third one is, why fantastical stories specifically? So those are the three big philosophical questions.
Well, I find it actually difficult to answer the question why I write because I don't actually remember a time when I wasn't making up stories. So, you know, I don't know what motivated me then. I think, you know, people were interested in what I was doing and I liked that. I was telling them stories and I was, you know, for that moment, I had them like an actor has their audience. And, you know, so maybe it was an ego thing. I don't know. I think that I wanted, as I grew older, I wanted to write because I admired the writers that I knew so much that I wanted to do that too. You know, in the same way that I admired my teachers, so I wanted to teach, which is, you know, one of the reasons that I went through to graduate school. But so it's not an in that respect, it's not an easy question to answer. But I think it might be. I think that it's important. I think that people come to literature, regardless of the genre, to help them understand something, and either themselves, the world they live in, usually one of those, or both. And I think that writing, and obviously reading as well, you're participating, I think you're participating more in the world. Because your personal experience is going to be limited by your situation and your circumstances. Reading gives you every experience possible, including, you know, what it was like to live in Russia in the 18th century, you know, or whatever. And so if we sort of take that a little bit further and say, like, why fantasy writing? I think that what you can do with fantasy and in science fiction is you can put your characters through situations that are very clear, that you couldn't do if you weren't writing a fantasy novel. And your characters have to be tested and they have to come out of the test. And I feel that fantasy novels do that best. You know, you only have to think of Lord of the Rings to see what I'm getting at. Mm-hmm. So I think that in many ways, non-genre fiction doesn't actually help with that. You know, you have to be distanced enough, I think, with the fantasy to be able to come to terms with sometimes the horror and sometimes merely the difficulty that people go through. And if you are able to use fantasy elements, sometimes, at least in my opinion, you show these situations, these tests, these trying times, you show them far more clearly and far more understandably than you could do if you were not writing fantasy.
And you've already mentioned it, but what fantasy are you working on now?
Ah, well, it's the follow-up to The Godstone. And at the moment, it doesn't have a title, as I say. So basically, it's in a way, obviously in The Godstone, the major situational problem of the book is solved by the end. And then this, so the follow-up book is kind of a, well, you know, what are we doing now? And did we really solve the problem in a permanent way?
And do you know when that one will be coming out?
Well, and if they want to do, like, you know, as they normally do, as you know, they like to have the follow-up book come out the next year. So in that respect, I would expect it to come out next August. But of course, you don't know anything until you're actually told where your position is on the publication schedule.
Yeah. Do you have anything else in the works?
I don't think I've mentioned them yet, but I wrote 4 sword and sorcery novels that I call the Dylan and Parno series because those are the names of the characters. And what I've been doing in, like, when I'm not actively working on the novel, which is pretty well every day, but anyway, like as soon as I finish this draft, I'm going to write a Dylan and Parno short story. So that's, and I've written, you know, Joshua Palmateer.
Yes. He'll be on the show in the near future.
Oh, there you go. And, you know, he, with his Zombies Need Brains, his publishing house, he publishes all kinds of anthologies.
Yeah, I've done a couple of short stories for him.
I've written a couple of short stories for him. Exactly. So, you know, it's an opportunity for me to like, Dylan and Parno are practically my favorite characters of all the characters that I've made up. So I'm really happy to be able to get back to them and give, you know, give them something to do. So that's usually what I'm doing in the writing sense in between times that I'm focused on the novel.
And where can people find you online?
Facebook and Twitter. I have a website, but I don't think I've touched it in like 5 years.
I think 2014 was the last date I saw on there when I looked.
Okay, so that would be 7 years. Something happened and I stopped being able to access it. So I don't know. I think something happened from changing from one computer to another. I'm not very savvy with these things because in theory, at least, I should be able to access it no matter where I am and no matter what I'm using. Mm-hmm. So I haven't done a lot with it. But if I usually tell people exactly what's going on, I post every day on Twitter and on Facebook, and essentially I'm talking about what I'm doing my writing process, like what I did that day, what I'm hoping to do the rest of the week. You know, I talk about my work rather than myself, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, that more than covers the hour. So that was a great chat. Thanks for being on the World Shapers.
Well, I had a great time. I mean, as you can tell, I like talking about myself. So, you know, always fun. And you've got great questions, you know. I know that you said like, oh, you know, this question is sort of like, you know, you always get asked this question. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't a question that should be asked.
Well, that's what I feel, yeah.
Yeah, because you do, in fact, want to know these very things about other people. You know, what is their process? How do they write? You know, like Tanya always used to write from 1 o'clock in the afternoon to six. And she'd do like her household stuff in the morning. And I found that if I did household stuff in the morning, I never got around to writing that day. So I get up and start writing. And everything else has to wait until I've finished writing. That's working out really well, great, here, now that we're in Spain, because now, since Paul is retired, he does everything around the house that I used to do. So I actually have more writing time. And oddly enough, Tanya is starting to write in the morning because she says her afternoon and evening brain is not reliable.
I procrastinate until I feel too guilty not to write some more, and then I do a lot, so...
I'm not big on the guilty part. I'm big on the procrastination, though. I can always convince myself that, you know, I don't really feel bad about this.
Well, thanks for sharing your process and and Tanya's too. So Tanya was actually second or third guest on here. So back in 2018 is when I talked to her when this first started.
Oh, fantastic.
So if you want to go back and look, you'll find her there.
She and Marie Bilodeau and I did a podcast for the Broadcast from the Wasteland. And that was a lot of fun to have the like three of us at the same time. But I think, you know, they probably recorded, I don't know, 2.5 hours, 3 hours worth of stuff. So, and then obviously, oh, in fact, they put it into two different podcasts.
I've only done that once when I talked to somebody who talked so long that I couldn't justify putting it in one, and that was Orson Scott Card. It was 2 hours with him. But nobody's going to complain about 2 hours of listening to him.
No,
so it
worked out okay. Exactly.
So you're a little over an hour. That's still within my parameters. It's not like I'm a broadcast station and have to, you know, fit around the commercials or anything. So again, thanks so much, and hopefully we'll
you're very welcome.
See each other in person again sometime.
Yeah, I hope so.
And I'll say goodbye here then.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
So thanks again to Violet for that wonderful conversation. I certainly enjoyed that, and I hope that you did as well. That brings us to the end of another episode of The World Shapers. Just a reminder that you can find The World Shapers online at theworldshapers.com. You can find it on Twitter at The World Shapers. You can find it on Facebook at The World Shapers. You can find me at edwardwillett.com, two T's on Willett. You can find me on Facebook at edward.willett. You can find me on Twitter at ewillett. And you can find me on Instagram at edwardwillettauthor. And you can find Shadowpaw Press, which will be publishing Shapers of Worlds Volume 2, the anthology featuring second-year guests of this podcast after publishing Shapers of Worlds, the original first-year guests anthology last year. It's at shadowpawpress.com. It's on Twitter at Shadowpaw Press and on Facebook at Shadowpaw Press. One other thing that I need to mention is that the World Shapers is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network.
The Saskatchewan Podcast Network is supported by Kinexus. Savings, checkings, GIC, budget, RESP, RRSP, TFSA, mutual funds, credit score, emergency funds, variable versus fixed rates, compound interest, retirement. The list goes on and on. It's time to make sense of it all. At Kinexus Credit Union, they want to help. Financial literacy is a critical life skill, giving you the knowledge and confidence to make smart, responsible decisions about your money. Visit kinexusmoneytalk.ca to find expert advice, tips, and solutions for all life stages and events, and increase your financial literacy knowledge and confidence today.
There you go. That's proof that I am part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. And again, that wraps up this episode of The World Shapers. I'll be back with, I've got all kinds of great guests coming up. Joshua Palmateer, Laurel K. Hamilton, David Liss. Many, many great guests already lined up or in the works. So do please keep coming back to listen to The World Shapers and to hear science fiction and fantasy authors talk about how they go about creating all the wonderful stories and characters and worlds that we have enjoyed reading about and in, I guess you would say, over the years. That's it for this episode. Bye for now.